Welcome to Technotopia, the podcast about a better future. I'm John Biggs. Today on the show, we have Emilio Ferrara. He is a researcher into botnets. This is Technotopia.
Technotopia is brought to you by Happy Fun Corp. Happy Fun Corp is a design-driven technology company in Brooklyn, New York that specializes in building mobile and web applications for startups and Fortune 500 companies. Whether it's a new mobile or web application that will help people experience the internet in a fun new way, or software that will interface with a new piece of top-secret hardware, Happy Fun Corp is always up to the challenge. Big or small, Happy Fun Corp loves building software and loves working with great people. Come build with them. HappyFunCorp.com.
Welcome back to Technotopia, a podcast about a better future. I'm John Biggs. Today on the show, we have Emilio Ferrara. He's a research assistant professor at the computer science department at USC and the research leader at the USC Information Science Institute. That was a mouthful. Welcome, Emilio. Thank you for joining us.
Happy to be here.
Yeah. So I got really excited today for the first time in a long time because you posted that you have created some Twitter bots that are going to make things okay for us.
You know, for almost 10 years now, I've been studying how social media have been manipulated for all sorts of nefarious negative purposes. And a couple of years ago, you know, as I was getting more and more into understanding how bots work, I became fascinated with this idea that bots could be maybe used for social good, for good things. Mm-hmm. That's how this project started.
Okay, so, I mean, so you've been studying this for 10 years. What kind of bots were you dealing with 10 years ago?
All sorts of things. We have seen an increase in the use of bots for manipulation of conversation online. You know, it started with platforms like Twitter and Facebook when they were still much younger than and smaller than now. And obviously, given that these platforms today have hundreds of millions or even billions of people, the dangers become more and more tangible, and the effects of the presence of these bots become incredibly dangerous. We've seen bots operating in the spectrum of political conversation, trying to manipulate political discussion. We have been, you know, studying how bots have affected a variety of conversations in the context of elections in the United States as well as all over the world. Only during, you know, the last year and a half, we looked at the U.S., of course, but we looked at the U.K., we looked at Italy, and this year we looked at France, and we are currently studying the German election that happened yesterday, actually. This is only one of the scenarios where social bots have been used for malicious purposes. We looked at the spreading of conspiracy theories, anti-science campaigns, for example, climate change denials or anti-vaccination campaigns. We have looked at how social bots have been used to manipulate the stock market. And we have, you know, we have been looking also at how bots have been used to kind of create mass hysteria during disasters, emergencies.
Mm-hmm. So, is this computer programs scaring human beings? Is that what's going on here? Is this basically just like a, or is there a there's always a human being behind these operations, but once you get these things started, are they automatic that you've seen?
That is a really good point. We have seen all sorts of things. We have seen bots that are completely automated. Their behavior is very, sometimes even very simple and predictable. And we have seen bots that are much more complex, bots that carry out a sort of an agenda. And you can see how they develop some narratives that are most likely fed by humans, and everything, you know, between these two extremes. So to answer your specific question regarding, you know, fear mongering, it is the case that in some particular conversations, especially those that are related to disasters, emergencies, crisis and so on, some bots have triggered this sort of mass hysteria in the public or in the public domain. So we have seen that, for example, clearly when Ebola, when the Ebola pandemic happened 2 years ago, we have seen how bots have been, you know, rebroadcasting, sharing large number of articles which were actually incorrect, as they were, you know, propagating rumors about the spreading of the disease in the United States, or rumors about specific events. And we saw how people reacted essentially in real time, and this was real, you know, fear mongering and spreading of hysteria. Especially in the U.S. population.
I mean, this sounds like a James Bond thing. So is this literally, there's somebody sitting in a room somewhere that says, hey, I want to scare everybody about Ebola?
It's really hard to answer this question for a number of reasons. It's actually very complex, because we have been revealing and unveiling a lot of these anomalies as they occur, oftentimes in a very timely way, you know, after a couple of weeks. In the case of the U.S. election, actually, we published the only peer review paper to appear on November 7th, so the day before the election, in which we revealed a lot of anomalies regarding how bots were pushing political discussions in certain divisions. So we have been trying to be timely. It's really hard because we have, you know, a small research team, but on the other hand, on the other side, as you suggested, possibly there are many organizations, possibly there are many entities, you know, some suggest there are state actors, maybe Russia or others, that have been carrying out some operations at scale. So it's really hard and really challenging to somewhat, you know, keep up with them.
Yeah, it's so strange. It's like It's almost like a mental virus that they've figured out how to implant, really.
It is. Unfortunately, it is working out well in at least from that perspective in a number of scenarios. We have seen how, you know, these discussions online, for example, in the context of anti-vaccination campaigns, have produced you know, the comeback of measles in, for example, in California last year, with an increasing rate of families who decide not to vaccinate their children. And we have seen that, you know, the stock market crashed in some occasions, and that there are, you know, allegations that operations using social bots might be behind these events. And we have seen all sorts of effects of social bots on political discussion in many, many countries.
It's a fascinating tool, and it's. But you're saying it's been around for a good 10 years, that people have started using these. But why did they only come to light recently? Why do we suddenly notice them?
Well, unfortunately, even though, as you suggested, the phenomenon is not entirely new, what is new is the, you know, exponential improvement that the technologies behind these bots have exhibited in the last couple of years. With, you know, the advancements of artificial intelligence, we see more and more sophisticated bots that look more and more like humans on these platforms. And it's also obviously harder and harder to detect them for us, because, you know, as time goes by, the bots become more and more human-like. If you add to that the fact that you can have, you know, real people instructing them and creating these agenda or narratives that the bots push, then it becomes really a very hard challenge to identify them. And it's really impossible to do it at scale. You need to look at specific conversations, specific events, to narrow down your attention on, you know, a subset of users that you can handle to manage with, even with our mostly advanced, you know, algorithms for detection.
Wow. So I want a couple more questions about the dystopian aspect of this, but then I want you to get into what you guys were working on. So these bots that you've seen, they're all made by a person. Somebody's made these things. Have you figured out who's making these things?
Very hard question to answer. For technical limitations, we are not actually provided with the data, with the digital footprints that we would need to make this type of inference. Twitter doesn't tell you, for example, which IP address has been used by the device which posted some, you know, particular tweet. We don't have, oftentimes, in the vast majority of the cases, their geographic location. We don't have all this information that is required to make this inference. So for us, it's really, really challenging to go back to who is behind the bots. We can make some hypotheses in certain particular scenarios. We have been, for example, we've been becoming increasingly more convinced that, for example, some communities organize and come together to deploy and deliver social bots, for example, to push alt-right narratives. We have seen that. We have evidence from other channels like 4chan or Reddit, and we have source code in some cases of these bots that are delivered online.
So there's a situation where people are saying, hey, everybody, let's get together. You guys, everybody create 10 accounts and run this program based on those 10 accounts.
We have seen even tools that allow you to automatically put your computer to their disposal so that they can operate.
Okay. All right. Well, hold on a second. Let's go to what you guys did. You guys did something very, very interesting. You guys use these bots for good, right?
We tried to do so. This was a challenge because, honestly, when we started thinking about this problem, it was around 2013 or 14. There were absolutely no examples of bots used for something good. So as of today, you know, fast forward 3 or 4 years, there are only 3 papers, which is funny because you can still count them on your hand.
Sure.
There are only 3 papers that used bots for social good. Our own work and 2 other papers that use bots to fight racism online, or to fight, to identify people who have suicidal thoughts and kind of put them in contact with, suicide prevention support groups, these kind of applications. So when we started thinking about these, again, back in 2013 or so, there was absolutely no evidence that bots could be used for something good. So this was a very challenging thought, and some people, you know, thought that that was crazy because, it's hard to determine whether people would be would receive this idea in a positive way.
Sure.
So that's what we tried to do. Come up with first, you know, bots for social good. Project at that time.
So why don't you describe the project? I guess it was 39 different bots that were tweeting out like happy things.
Yeah. So what we did was, in collaboration with my colleagues and friends from the Technical University of Denmark, they actually came up with this very clever idea to have a research project carried out by graduate students of a social bot engineering class, to come up with these bots that would be injected into Twitter according to some of the rules that we had to follow from the review board that sort of regulated the ethics of this study.
Sure.
So we came up with this idea of creating these positive interventions. Some of them were somewhat for fun, stuff like, you know, high five a stranger just to bring, you know, some happiness or some positive messaging on the platform. And some were actually aimed to be useful, like interventions aimed at fostering, you know, flu shots, this kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm. So what kind of messages did these people get? Did these bots send it out to the general internet, or did they resend?
Yeah, the bots were designed to target specifically the community of users who live in San Francisco, and that was a sort of a by design, sort of an engineering solution to narrow down the population of that would be exposed to this, so that, you know, to avoid that this message basically gets lost in the entire internet, in the entire platform. So very focused to a specific population. And of course, that's a large city, so there are, you know, thousands and thousands of users. So there was a sort of run-up period before the start of the intervention that lasted a couple of months, in which we deployed these bots. And this was actually really great work that my colleagues from Denmark did, deploying these bots into these communities and start basically so that the bots would start accruing followership. And this was already surprisingly successful because, you know, we thought that the bots would basically go unnoticed. And then we figure out instead that some of these bots got thousands of followers, which is incredible if you think about it. This was...
how are these bots getting followers? I can barely get followers.
Yeah, so it was really interesting. What we did was it was just a very simple set of rules. These bots would their accounts would be populated manually by the student who designed the bot.
Sure.
So that the bot would look sort of credible. It wouldn't have, you know, a default account with egg and no messages and stuff like that. So they would create sort of a realistic profile, and then they would define some of the topics of interest for the bot. Well, in that case, obviously, the people who interacted with these users didn't know that they were bot at that time, so that was a part of the ingredient for the success of some of these bots. And then, obviously, another ingredient was their activity. Since these are bots, they operate mostly in a completely automatic way. Mm-hmm. So many of them started, you know, publishing hundreds of tweets over the course of a few weeks.
So, if I said, like, I like Apple, and you checked everything out, and you said... I was getting the message, and I said, "Oh, this person likes Apple. I will follow them." Right? And
yeah.
Because the bot would reply like, "Hey, Apple's great."
Precisely, and this was this was one ingredient. It was a little bit more sophisticated than that as well, because these people, these bots, which looked like people to the eyes of, you know, the other users, could also mention users who exhibited some particular interest in, say, the hashtag, you know, Apple, just to follow your example, right? Could kind of get in touch with them, try to foster some of these interactions. And of course, that increased the success of being followed by the users. So long story short, after a couple of months, some of these accounts became really, really very successful with 5,000, 6,000, 7,000 followers each. Some of the bots that were, quote unquote, less successful still had a few hundred followers, which is very satisfactory. So we get into October 2014. And at that time, what we did was basically starting these interventions with these campaigns. So we have a dozen of these campaigns for social good that span from things for fun, like I Five a Stranger, or, you know, Photoshop celebrity face on a turkey for, you know, Thanksgiving. So all these were contextualized with events in the offline world, right?
Okay.
There were some things related to, you know, Black Friday, and of course there were some things related to the flu season, et cetera, et cetera. So we implemented all these campaigns for social good, again, in a sort of orchestrated, synchronized, automatic way. So the bots at certain, you know, point in time would start tweeting about this specific campaign. And then we observe, you know, how many times each bot becomes retweeted, which tweets become retweeted more, which user retweeted bots more, and so on. So this was the study had basically a twofold goal. The first was the proof of concept, right? Mm-hmm. We want to understand whether you can use bots for this positive type of operations rather than for all the nefarious purposes that we know.
How did you measure that these people are actually listening?
Well, what we did was sort of a proxy to that. What we try to understand is whether the people became engaged with the bots and try to sort of adopt those particular hashtags.
So right? retweets, hashtags, all that other good stuff. Interesting.
Precisely. And the second thing is that, you know, once we collected all these data from all the users who interacted with the bots, we were capable of understanding how information spreads on these platforms.
Mm-hmm.
We have some, you know, mathematical models that we developed that try to represent and capture how information passes from one person to another on a statistical basis. And we tested some of these models, and eventually we figured out that there is a specific model that is called complex contagion that explains information diffusion very well.
Okay, so and that's the idea that if you see things multiple times, you're more likely to spread them.
That's absolutely correct. So there are two different sort of ideas or competing hypotheses in the literature. The first one is that information somehow spreads like epidemics. Every time someone who has the flu, for example, sneezes in your face,
mm-hmm.
you have some probability of becoming infected. And it doesn't matter if who is sneezing in your face, if it's different friends or the same person multiple times and so on. So people thought that information spreading online works kind of like epidemics. This was the first attempt to model information diffusion, but throughout the course of the last couple of years, people have been starting doubting that that's the case. Maybe there is a more complex dynamic behind information diffusion, and that's why this idea of the complex contagion came about. And this idea, again, as you said, sort of suggests that it is important not only how many times you are exposed to a piece of information, but also how many sources you see it from. So somehow seeing something from multiple friends increases your likelihood to adopt yourself that piece of information, that hashtag, retweeting that specific tweet.
So this is an interesting question. Should somebody who has a technically positive message, I mean, it's all relative, right? So maybe my message of getting Nazis into the White House is positive for me, but should positive messages use the same tools and bot systems that negative ones do now? Should we fight back with fire?
That is an excellent question. So I've been talking about this issue for several years now with a lot of colleagues in my research community. And it turns out that the answer to your question is really, really hard to provide. And the reason is the following. You want to understand first whether answering with fire, quote unquote, as you suggested, is a good idea or not. And it turns out that probably is not a good idea. And the reason is the following. There are some studies that have been carried out by cognitive scientists or social psychologists. One of these studies recently published by Stanford University, they ran a real experiment asking, bring students to a lab. So these are, Stanford graduate students may be, arguably some of the most intelligent people on the planet, right?
Mm-hmm.
These students were tasked with the goal of determining whether some news were true or not, so fact or fiction, right? So fake news versus not. And it turns out that even though, these people are super smart, it turns out they do slightly better than random. So the first issue here, it's really, really hard, even for humans, even for smart, educated, knowledgeable people to tell apart oftentimes true from false, fact from fiction. This was a very disconcerting result that came about, a couple of months ago. And the follow-up study actually somewhat demonstrated the fact that many people are very reluctant about changing their mind. Once they see something, they kind of stick to that belief, especially if this reinforces their pre-existing ideas or beliefs. And this is something that in cognitive sciences is called the confirmation bias. If you have some pre-existing belief and you see a piece of information that reinforces that belief, then you are less likely to change your mind, increasingly less likely to change your mind. So what these people in this other study did was trying to develop to deploy some interventions in which the individuals who were exposed to some piece of fake news were told, look, this is really fake. You have been tricked. The reality is the opposite. And then ask to these people a couple of weeks later about their recollection. What was the fact? Was it true or was it false? And actually, and this is very worrisome, the majority of the people who were subject to this correction intervention told the opposite. Mm-hmm. They were more inclined to believe that the fake news was real, as opposed to the people who were simply not told the truth. So actually, telling someone to change their mind make them stick even more to the false message. So you see how this becomes very, very quickly not only a technological challenge, mm-hmm. of, you know, how to implement the bots, how many bots we need, how they should work, what communities they should target, all these technical challenges that computer scientists can face very well. This becomes much more of a challenge also for cognitive scientists, for social psychologists, and so forth, to understand how you should do these interventions.
How to change people's minds.
Yeah, what you should do to change people's minds, especially to correct wrong beliefs, because it's not clear as of today that you could do that very effectively in a systematic way.
So it's not horrible, but it's not good either.
It is not all is bad. There are strategies that at least do not harm. There are strategies that maybe don't work out, but in the worst case, don't cause more harm than the good that they provide. So there are some techniques. There is hope for the future that, you know, research can have a sort of a concerted success in coming from multiple disciplines, from multiple directions, mm-hmm. bringing together, you know, the computer science and the other communities to solve these issues.
Okay. All right. Well, here's my hope. I hope that someday these bots are just going to talk to each other, and the whole internet's going to explode, and then we can go back to talking to each other face to face. Maybe that's the best future.
I think that in one, as a closing sentence of one of my more popular papers on this topic, I said, we are probably headed towards this, you know, dystopian future in which we will have platforms where only bots operate and they talk to each other without knowing that they are bots, and the humans will be somewhere else.
All right. Well, okay. That sounds a little bit better, I guess. That's sort of like eventually they won't even be using language. It'll just be gibberish. It'll be just zip files. Emilio, thank you very much for joining us. This has been some fascinating stuff. I'm glad we got to cover some breaking news on here too. That's really great.
Absolutely. Happy to contribute.
And where can people find some of your papers or anything? Do you have anything online?
Everything is on my webpage. I am very much for open science. Lots mm-hmm. of data, lots of papers are all in the public domain. People will be able to read all of these things if they start from my website.
All right. Emilio Ferrara, Research Assistant Professor at the Computer Science Department at USC. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Take care.
This has been Technotopia. I'm John Biggs. We will see you next week.
Technotopia is brought to you by Typewriter. Typewriter is your on-demand editor, and their amazing team of writers will make your book chapter, blog post, or email shine. Typewriter editors come from places like TechCrunch, Gizmodo, and the New York Times, and they offer low bulk rates for longer work. Check it out at typewriter.plus. That's typewriter.plus.